welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we go back into the Sidetrack archives for some summertime features. This month, we're all about sitting by the pool and listening to music while enjoying a tropical drink or two. We'll revisit some of rock and roll's most enduring myths, learn about the classic tiki bar drink, the Zombie, and hear about one man's obsession with water parks. We'll have those stories and more this time on Sidetrack. A couple of years ago, we featured the story of a strange electronic musical instrument created here at the University of Illinois by electrical and computer engineering professor Leopold Hocken. It's called the Continuum Fingerboard. This summer, the Continuum Fingerboard can be heard in the movie blockbuster Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. From the May 2006 edition of Sidetrack, here's Jeff Bossert with the story.
With the fingerboard hooked up to a large keyboard, Mark Smart, an electronics technician and local jazz guitarist, demonstrates a saxophone sound.
Basically, it's set up so that the left to right direction is controlling pitch, and then when you push harder, the pressure is controlling the volume and also the brightness of the sound to try to imitate the way the saxophone gets brighter when you blow harder on it. And then I also have the front back direction is controlling growl. If you play toward yourself, you get a clean sound, and if you play farther away, you get kind of a growl. And this actual sound is coming from this keyboard over here, which is basically a Windows PC in a box with the keyboard.
All the saxophone sound, all whatever you want to emulate, it comes from the keyboard.
Yeah, the Continuum itself is a controller. It's not a synthesizer, so it just sends MIDI, which is a musical instrument digital interface, to control some other unit that actually produces the sound. It's really good for doing saxophone sounds and also for imitating Eddie Van Halen.
In order to produce a variety of sounds, Professor Leopold Hocken says he took his musical background and applied what he knew.
I wanted to do something in music and use my engineering skills doing it. And I'd been, my parents had me play violin all through my youth, and so I'm, you know, in violin playing, the vibrato is really important. Swell stirring notes, like crescendo stirring notes and glissandi and such, are all really important for expression. So I wanted to build an instrument that was keyboard-like, but had the same sort of expressive capabilities. And that's really where it came from.
Did you have a concept of what you wanted to do? Is this something that... You saw the final product?
Well, actually, I tried a lot of different approaches. The idea of just having a surface where you place your fingers and you have to place them exactly to get the right pitch, sort of like on a fretless guitar or on a violin fingerboard, that idea I had really early on, but how to actually build electronics for it was tough. And I went through a lot of different designs. The challenge there from the electronic side is that when you play a vibrato, you're only moving your finger a fraction of a millimeter. And it has to be able to track that, and has to be able to track that for lots of different fingers. And that's nobody's built a device that can do that yet.
And what kind of effects were you trying to pull off that would otherwise require holding down on some effect up here on a keyboard?
Right, and a keyboard player does that. A keyboard player has a pitch wheel, but that affects all the notes in the chord the same. It doesn't have the same sort of freedom. It sounds more... electronic, more mechanical than it does if each finger is vibrating individually. And all these things that you can do in a fretless string instrument, you can also do on this instrument.
How long did it take to finish this?
Well, I guess I started, I was with a group of students building music synthesizers and keyboards and also a pitch extractor, a thing that tracks singing. I was doing that in the early 80s when I was just finishing up my undergraduate and starting graduate school. So I think 84 is the first time I really wrote up the idea.
Can you name something that's easier to play now and what you wanted to emulate?
Oh, actually, easier to play is an interesting thing. You know, people always expect electronics to make their life easier, and in synthesizers, it's especially that way. One of the big frustrations for keyboard players is they sit down and play this instrument, doesn't play like a keyboard, and they don't like that. It's rare to find somebody who'll take the time and really realize that, no, this is a new instrument. I'm a keyboard player. If I were to start playing violin now, I could expect to spend years learning it. This isn't maybe not that big a leap, but it's a pretty big leap. Certainly the idea wasn't to make it easier. It was more to, like I say, to bring something of what you have, say, in the singing voice or in violin, in all those instruments where vibrato is so important and glissando is so important.
Fully utilizing the keyboard, Mark Smart records a bass line from the fingerboard, then adds to it.
Professor Hawkins, as many others, have contributed to the fingerboard while he built it the last few years.
It was one of many projects. It was sort of a back burner thing. It was a big enough project that sort of went in fits and starts. But I would run into people and tell them about the idea, and people would have idea of different kinds of sensing devices to use, different kinds of technology to use. And also, not being a very good performing musician myself, I really need a musician's feedback. Because almost all the improvements since like the last 6 or 7 years have been performers asking for changes. It's not like if you get a grand piano, but there's all these piano technique books that you can follow and you can go a step-by-step program and learn how to play piano. There's no such thing for this, so a lot of it's sort of your own discovery.
One of my most obvious questions, I mean, everybody's got to learn this thing by trial and error. I mean, it's not as if there's a continuing fingerboard teacher out there.
That's right, and also people all have very different playing styles. It's just now beginning that some of the continuum fingerboard players are imitating others, but that's really a new thing. It's still a small enough thing that most people develop their own playing technique, and most people play very different styles of music.
Yeah, how does this relate to what you do on campus?
Well, it's very nice. The interest of the students is very good. There's a lot of students, partly just because of iPods and such, that hear a lot of music, and then so they'll be fans of some of the bands. There's certainly some very very loyal Dream Theater fans here that I've run into. So the students like to see, when I'm teaching a class, right, it's interesting for them that this band that they listen to willingly on their own, that they really enjoy, that I contributed something there. So I'm hoping that over time I can help nurture that, the next generation of people that are going to go out and do the cutting-edge new things and get that mix of electrical engineering and music.
Dream Theater is a progressive metal band that uses the Continuum fingerboard. Other more familiar names of those who have taken up the instrument include John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin fame and Terry Lawless, a keyboardist with U2. The fingerboard was also recently used for sound effects in Steven Spielberg's remake of War of the Worlds. Professor Hawken and Mark Smart have been to some trade shows with the instrument, but with a retail value between $3,000 and $5,500, depending on the model, Hawken says he doesn't want to add the expense of paying a distributor. And Hawken says he didn't design the Continuum fingerboard to get rich, adding he has realistic expectations for an instrument that will take some time for others to learn about, not to mention figure out how to play. I'm Jeff Bossert.
You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. In the world of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, there's a fine line between truth and urban legend. Sorting fact from fiction is Gavin Edwards, former columnist for Rolling Stone magazine. A couple of years ago, he published a book titled, Is Tiny Dancer Really Elton's Little John? music's most enduring mysteries, myths, and rumors revealed. It's published by Three Rivers Press. I talked with Edwards for the November 2006 program and asked him what is the number one rock myth and which question he gets asked the most.
I'd say that, you know, one is the one and the same. And the one I get asked over and over, people want to know, did the Ohio Players stab a woman while they were recording Love Roller Coaster? Just sort of, it astonished me, like, the frequency with which I got this letter. But it's one of those things with rock myths, like, you hear them when you're 12, and they just, like, you know, latch on your brain, and you can't let go. So it's, I actually answered that. The book is Tiny Dancer, Really Elton's Little John, started as a collection of columns in Rolling Stone magazine. And the very first column, I answered it. I got one of the Ohio Players on the phone, and, you know, he, of course, had heard the story himself over and over. And he said, you know, we've never been arrested. We've never been incarcerated. He said, some of us have been handcuffed. We've had some wild times, but that's different.
And so the answer is?
The answer is no, of course not. You know, for a variety of, you know, aside from the fact that the Ohio Players are not homicidal maniacs, there's, you know, if you killed a woman in the studio and it just happened to be on tape, wouldn't you erase the tape instead of releasing it?
I would think, you know, reading your book and knowing about music, urban myths, I would have thought the Paul McCartney, Paul is Dead urban legend, or not really an urban legend, but the Carly Simon, You're So Vain.
Right.
Figuring
well,
out who's
Paul
the...
Paul is Dead, I think, you know, had as big a hold on people as anything in its time, where people were really obsessed with it, especially when you find out you can sort of play Revolution Number 9 backwards and it sounds like Turn Me On, Dead Man. But at this point, it's mostly people goofing around with it. You know, sort of no one thinks Paul is actually dead, although there are websites where people sort of have fun, like, looking for further clues in, like, Paul McCartney solo albums. But, you know, they're basically just goofing around at this point. So it's more just kind of like an interesting bit of history that, you know, sort of like, wow, was there really, like, a year when people thought that? And, like, what were the clues that made them think that? Because it all seems so remote now. You're So Vain is absolutely, like, one of those ongoing questions. And, you know, sort of Carly is smart enough to know that, you know, sort of the mystery is part of what piques people, which is why she's, you know, dropped hints at various points, but, you know, it doesn't blurt out the secret. But her current husband was a little more loose-lipped than her, which is why I was able to answer the question in the book, because there's lots of people it's been connected to, you know, sort of, is it Warren Beatty, who's obviously vain enough for it to be possible? Is it Mick Jagger, who sang backing vocals on it? Is it James Taylor, who she's married to? And according to her husband, it's none of these people. It's just, you know, sort of like a guy she went out with before she was famous. But, you know, sort of Carly comes from money. Her father was the Simon and Simon & Schuster publishers. So she sort of traveled in a jet-set crowd, and she had a jet-setter boyfriend who was apparently that vain.
And as the old saying goes, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Right. You know, and if she tells people this, well, hey, it's just this guy, it's nobody special, people go, oh, okay. If they think, but it might be Warren Beatty, you know, like, it's much more titillating.
Which band or person do you think has the most rock and roll urban legend attached to them?
Well, I think there's probably the most, like, curiosity about various aspects of the Beatles story, just because they're... kind of like the version of a rock band that, you know, sort of there were so many different things they did, and they were so central to the culture that there's so many different that people are interested in sort of even like the smallest details of the studio, like, oh, hey, did you know that Ringo got the distinctive drum sound by putting like the eight-armed sweater from the Beatles photo shoot in his bass drum, and that was like why it sounded the way it did. But I think the band that sort of defined like sort of the debauchery rock myth was Led Zeppelin. That there's this sense of, you know, they really just kind of shattered the boundaries of, you know, like being a band, you know, sort of like fornicating out on the road and drinking and doing everything excessive that they could. And I think that's a lot of what people look at when there's rock band urban legends. It's because people want to hear stories about things they wouldn't be doing themselves, but they might want to. It's like, ah, there's bad behavior. You know, I can at least experience it vicariously.
Well, the old sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Sure.
Yeah. Now, the thing is about your book, it's not just about rock and roll urban legends. There's actual real things that actually happen that sort of like, you know, the classic bands trashing hotel rooms or doing this or that. you say, yeah, some of this actually did happen.
Sure.
Was there one story which you, you know, got the question for your column, and you said, there is no way that this could be true? And then it actually turned out, yeah, it actually did happen.
There were several, and but the one that sort of immediately comes to mind was I got a letter saying, is it true that Pink Floyd made an entire album using household objects? I thought, well, of course not. But, you know, I'm like, well, it's still an interesting question. So let me try to figure out, like, what this is. Maybe it was a different band that tried it. It turns out that, you know, Pink Floyd didn't actually make an album doing that, but they tried to. After Dark Side of the Moon they came out, they had sort of sold a gazillion copies. They didn't know what to do next, and they sort of started doing, like, these little science experiments in the studio where they'd sort of get, like, hammers and brooms and pieces of tape, and they were using them to try to, like, make musical sounds. And, you know, sort of after a couple of months, they realized, well, there's a reason people use musical instruments. It's much easier to go ahead and play music on them. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. So they dropped the project, but I think it sort of cleansed their palate where they were able to actually go ahead and make their next album.
Now, a lot of bands, they don't mind if urban legends and myth and lore are associated with them. You know, they, in fact, a lot of bands, I'm sure, encourage that. But has this ever backfired on someone? Has it ever ruined a career?
I don't think at this point that's possible. That, you know, you take a band like Marilyn Manson, where there's lots of stories attached, and before them, say, like Ozzy Osbourne, and some of the same stories, you know, sort of like they kill puppies, or and it just adds into it. Burnishes the myth of, you know, like, this person is actually the Antichrist Booga Booga. But there's definitely people who thought, like, Scandal were going to destroy their career. When the Madonna nude photos came out in the early 80s, you know, sort of obviously things worked out for her. But I remember she genuinely thought at the time, you know, this could be a huge thing that sort of, like, knocks the legs out from under my career. The Kinks weren't able to tour the United States for 4 or 5 years in the 60s, and it's not go into this in the book, and it's not 100% clear exactly what it was, whether they were blacklisted because they hadn't paid their dues in a union or because they had gotten in an argument with somebody powerful. But at the time when the band was at its peak, you know, sort of they weren't able to go what could have been one of their biggest markets. And, you know, so they never really got big in the United States until the 70s.
So why do you think this group of people, rock stars,
yes,
why do you think this group is so well-suited for these types of stories?
I often talk about people as being good rock stars. Like, there's plenty of musicians I like who just sort of, you know, like, are actually kind of sort of quiet and retired. Like, Van Morrison makes great albums, but he's not a particularly great rock star. You know, he's sort of just kind of, like, grumpy and hangs around. Courtney Love, you know, has made good music at various points, but is much more sort of uneven and probably less talented. But she's a great rock star. You know, she's outrageous. You know, she does excessive things in public. You know, she's always, like, a good, reliable bit of scandal. So, you know, there's the sort of people who are, you know, leave scandal in their wake everywhere they go. You know, sort of they're attracted to the notion of, like, getting on stage in front of a lot of people and being the center of attention. So it all kind of perpetuates itself. And if they're good at that, and if people enjoy what, you know, that keeps on going, and they'll get more successful, and, you know, one thing leads to another.
So would you call them modern-day folk heroes?
Modern-day Greek god archetypes, maybe? You know, sort of like a... you know, in some cases it's Apollo, and in some cases it's Dionysus. But it's sort of people that we can attach stories to, who are sort of like going across the land, leaving a wake of either sort of music or destruction or hangovers behind them.
So, how did the column that this book is based on, that you did for Rolling Stone, how did the column come about? And in the course of doing the column, what was the strangest thing that someone asked you?
The column came about just because I got asked a lot of these questions at parties, and the more I thought about it, the more I said, well, you know, if my friends are asking me to, like, vet this stuff and see what's real and what's not, surely, you know, like, other people would be interested in hearing the answers. And so I started off with, like, you know, just kind of a handful of questions from friends, but it seemed like interesting stuff. It was, you know, like, what kind of grades did Mick Jagger get at the London School of Economics? And it was one of the very first questions was the title of the book, Is Tiny Dancer Really Elton's Little John? Somebody said, you know, who's the guy singing to in Tiny Dancer? You know, like, I always thought it was some kind of woman muse, but my friend insists, you know, like, he's singing to his private parts, you know, like, Tiny Dancer in My Hand. And I said, well, you know, how do you find out? Well, the guy who wrote the song is Bernie Taupin. He wrote the lyrics. Let me see if I can get him on the phone. And I could, and I asked him, I said, like, hey, here's this theory. And he laughed and said, no, I would never belittle myself so. So just doing the first couple, I said, this works. I'm finding out, even though I've immersed myself in music for decades now, I'm finding out things that I didn't know. And so if it's interesting to me, it's going to be interesting to other people.
So what was the strangest thing that someone ever asked you?
The strangest thing? There were definitely things that, you know, sort of surprised me. I was always interested in, you know, sort of people would just, like, know really lurid specific rumors, like they would have heard that, like, Frank Zappa, you know, got drafted because he was a pornographer, and just trying to sort of, like, go back and vet some of those things. You know, sort of, did the Allman Brothers have a foot shooting party so Greg wouldn't have to go to Vietnam? So there's just, like, these juicy little, like, byways of rock and roll that turn out to be actual stories.
So, I mean, they're true?
Many of them. Greg did, in fact, shoot his foot, you know, sort of, like, they called the ambulance first, and when they heard the sirens, you know, like, pulled the trigger and went into the induction center on crutches the next day and didn't have to serve. Frank Zappa was not drafted because of being a pornographer, but he got he served time because he made a porn audio tape in what turned out to be a sting operation by the local sheriff's department, spent about a month in jail, and as a result was a convicted felon and so couldn't be drafted.
So are you working on a sequel?
Kicking it around. You know, sort of, there's always crazy things happening, and they still get questions. So, you know, sort of enjoying this one for a little while, but maybe next year, start thinking about putting another one together.
That was Gavin Edwards, author of Is Tiny Dancer Really Elton's Little John? Music's Most Enduring Mysteries, Myths, and Rumors Revealed. That's from an interview we did back in 2006. His book was published by Three Rivers Press. This is Sidetrack. Summer is just about here, and one of the great joys of the season is pools and water parks. Last summer, we featured an essay from Londoner Neil McQuillan, who had just discovered the joys of water parks and quickly became obsessed with them.
In London, when it's hot, there's nowhere to go. The city expands outwards round you, layer after layer of oppressively hot brick, stone, and concrete. Homes don't have air conditioning, nor do many public buildings. The large ornamental fountains in the parks have normally been out of order since the olden days, and the drinking fountains are relics, to go with the old horse troughs filled with flowers. We don't have fire hydrants that conveniently go haywire. We do sometimes go to the seaside, but by the time we get there, the weather will probably have changed. So we walk by the river or in the parks, but it's always a case of delaying the inevitable, of keeping the heat at bay. We don't make friends with the heat or tame it, but then, it just doesn't get all that hot in Britain. Not like here. A walk in the park just doesn't cut the mustard here. Drastic measures are required. Hence the water park, where mankind and sweltering heat come together in blissful union. I can't overstate how much the heat here has affected me during my month's stay in Champagne. Every time I moved out of air-conditioned space, I exploded with sweat. The water parks I visited have been oases. There have been three. First, Sholem Aquatic Center here in Champaign, then Caribbean Water Adventure in Springfield, and finally Indiana Beach. Each one bigger than the next. I loved them all. As they got bigger, it may well be that my overall excitement grew. But let that take nothing away from my delight as I sat in my tube and trundled gently down the modest length of unambitious slide that leads into Champaign's Lazy River. Just because I wasn't screaming in terror, as I did while plummeting down the Devil Ray, Springfield's dastardly bastardization of a skate park halfpipe, doesn't mean I wasn't feeling something very special indeed on the inside. The park in Champaign is small but perfectly formed, unlike Indiana Beach, which is small but bloated with steroids. The space has been used with restraint. When I went, it felt peaceful, which may be because it does not try to be non-stop thrills, and also because it's situated at a public park. As you climb the steps to the slides or luxuriate in the Lazy River, you can see trees and grass around you, just beyond the perimeter fence. It's cheap enough to go to on a whim, just $5 for residents, and is perfect for water park virgins like myself. Springfield's Caribbean Water Adventure, on the other hand, is a little pricier, and you're surrounded by freeway rather than parkland. Nonetheless, it was my favourite of the three parks. The Devil Ray, that slippery halfpipe, brought out noises in my friend and I that grown men shouldn't be capable of. And another ride, like a huge toilet bowl, processed our puny frames with such disdain, flinging us round and around before plopping us gracelessly into the cistern, that there was as much pleasure to be had watching as there was in taking part. Springfield also had a powerful wave pool, which was a touch of class neither of us was expecting. It was sitting quietly over on the other side of the park, waiting for us to notice it, and it was the perfect place to let the slide adrenaline dissipate. Each ride was so different from the next here that we felt we got more than our money's worth. Craving bigger and bigger kicks, I gobbled up tales of the legendary Indiana Beach. My host promised that we would visit, and true to his word, the day finally came. We walked across a beautiful suspension bridge from the parking lot and entered a chaotic forging of roller coaster and water slide, spliced and crisscrossed along a sliver of land in Lake Schaefer. It has been put together in such a crazy angled, higgledy-piggledy fashion that just finding where to pay is a triumph. Finding anything actually is like finding Waldo. There were signs everywhere, leering at us like faces on a ghost train ride. Once on our way in the park, narrow walkway after narrow walkway, there was a sense of being herded, sheep going for their dip, whether they liked it or not. The swimming pool was lake water, with an artificial beach alongside. The sand was like chicken feed. A large metal canister, painted in flaking turquoise, muscularly pumped an arc of water over the swimming pool. It looked like it once serviced crops with fertilizer. I trust they gave it a good scrub before its career change. The lazy river there, actually called an action river, perhaps because of the speed of the water flow, getting you in and out as quickly as possible, passed directly beneath the slides and roller coaster tracks. It felt rather industrial, like we were flotsam floating on the top of some sort of cooling system in a factory. It also meant that one unfortunate lifeguard had to actually stand in the river here, in the dank shadows of the dripping coaster tracks and slide underbellies. I felt bad for him as I sailed lazily by. One sad fact I found hard to swallow is that not everyone loves a water park like I do. The lifeguards, brown as berries, looked universally bored. Some sparked into life when spoken to, others didn't. One guard, attending the highest slides at Indiana Beach, was less than chatty. As we reached the top, excitedly trying to decide which slide to go down, another visitor, also chomping at the bit, came right out and asked her, the lifeguard, the person who would surely know, which is the best one? She adjusted her cap a little and shrugged, staring blankly into the middle distance. No matter, I thought. It's better to find out for yourself anyway. So for the record, I reckon the one on the right was better. You went further up the sides at the corners, and the links between the tube sections were pronounced enough to add the subtlest hint of pain to the journey down, which was actually kind of satisfying, like bumping down the stairs in a pillowcase. And there's the thing, I suppose. After just 3 water park trips, I was already fancying myself a connoisseur. A certain objectivity was creeping into my enjoyment. And objectivity can give way to cynicism, something I was going to the water parks to avoid.
That essay from Neil McQuillan first aired last August. Still to come on the program, a history of tiki bars in America and downtown Champaign's drinking fraternity. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. The University of Illinois is known for its large number of fraternities and sororities. But did you know a downtown Champaign bar has its own invitation-only society? It's called Pi Omega Omega, the Downtown Drinking Fraternity. Pi Omega Omega's members include everyone from dishwashers to graduate students, babies to bar owners. The only common points are a sense of humor, a nickname, and a meeting with the President Moose. From the April 2007 program, here's the story from Sidetrack's Matt Kessler.
I would like to say that 98% of this bar has a frat name.
Hi, my name's Mike. My frat name is Hooker. I live in Champaign and I'm a graduate student.
My name is Ryan Double Down Walker.
My name is George, and my frat name is Jungle. We had actually looked up in a dictionary that Jungle is actually from the Swahili Jungala. And so sometimes I go by Jungala.
The youngest frat member ever was named in utero. Babies in utero don't drink.
So much of the stuff is just kind of inside jokes that started between a couple of people in the frat, and nobody else really knows what the inside joke is, but they just kind of pick up on it and run with it. Kind of like chicken. Ah! Chicken.
The frat is Pi Omega Omega.
Pi Omega Omega is P-O-O, or...
poo.
The downtown frat is a mockery of the rather large Greek system at the University of Illinois. At least it started that way, and now it's more of just a nonsensical kind of big, huge inside joke that everyone is in on.
The frat is the downtown drinking culture community.
Mostly people who are industry workers, people who work restaurant, bars, things like that, people in the know.
It's a way to figure out who's the insiders and who's the outsiders.
I think that Pi Omega Omega and the word fraternity are usually not used in the same context. They don't really strive to be a quote-unquote fraternity in the sense that most people would associate terms with a fraternity. I think that they would strive to be a fraternity in the actual definition of the word, like if you need a shoulder, you got it. If you need a place to crash, you've got it. If something happened today that is really horrible, then, you know, hey, you can tell me about it, and we'll see what we can do to get through this, you know, and a few pints. I think that Pi Omega Omega actually embodies every good aspect of a fraternity.
Champaign, to me, is a college town that would be very uninteresting if not for the college, but at the same time, I personally dislike it revolving completely around the University of Illinois.
A regular frat, if somebody would say fraternity to me, the first thing I would think is a backwards hat, probably a trucker hat, you know, designer clothing, wasted talent with my parents' money sort of organization. The drinking fraternity, on the other hand, I think is more of like a working class, like, you know, it's like a working man's fraternity. Everybody that's in the fraternity has a job, and most of them work well over 40 hours a week.
The frat is very diverse. We've got professionals, we've got dishwashers, and we've got everybody in between. You know, other than the frat itself, there's no, like, single thread that ties everybody together, except that they know our president, Barney, or Moose, I should say.
I was not in on the beginnings of the frat. It started about 10 years ago. Moose was the one of the founders, Moose.
Moose, the president of Pi Omega, came in one night after a bout of drinking and socializing with other folks and told me that he had a dream.
Not that I'm comparing Moose to Buddha, but I must say that he has a very unique sense of humor that I think that we could all benefit from.
I was in his dream. I don't remember what all was happening in the dream, but I didn't know him very well, and he came in hardly able to stand up, walked right up to me and said, "Double Down. You are in my dream. Your name is Double Down."
My name is Moose. It was 10 years ago. A roommate and I were just sitting in our room, and basically we were always hanging out with the same people and getting drunk together. It's like, hey, we should give each other nicknames.
There are no assigned rules. There's no like assigned study sessions or good behavior monitors or obligated hours towards charity work or anything like that.
There are some official positions. Moose is the president. The vice president does not go out to the bars nearly as often as she did when the frat began.
I am not the best at keeping the rules, but 27 is always a magic number.
St. Jack is the god of drinking and gambling. He was a red-haired Viking with a giant mullet and mustache who had a pet chicken named Sweet Sue.
There's real talk and then there's...
sick talk.
Sick talk. Real talk is frat talk, and sick talk is real talk.
Things like calling their beer their wife, or their smokes their kids, home is jail, and pretty much all the bars in downtown have a frat nickname. My Kamali's, for instance, is the counseling center where people get together with their wives.
The Brass Rail is work, and I tend bar here 5 days a week, so I was given the official title of Secretary of Labor. A boyfriend or a girlfriend is a drinking problem.
In real talk, you have your wife, which is your beer. So right now, I'm actually married to my wife. And my alcohol problem's downstairs with his wife.
You know, I'd say there's a good couple dozen members of the frat that their frat name is the name they mostly go by.
More often than not, I refer to people by their frat name.
Everybody's welcome. There's no exclusions. You just have to become friends with a couple members of the frat and have them bring you to Moose. And, you know, you have to tell Moose a little bit about yourself, and then he comes up with a frat name.
Sometimes Barney's really drunk, and then he's got a thing in his head, and he goes, "Hey, your name is Doorknob." She's actually one of the ones that needs a name. How do you not have a name yet?
She was supposed to get one very recently.
A few years ago. Well, it never happened. It's, you know, it's a long story.
All right, you say you don't want just a random name. What should we know about you to give you a name?
I don't know. You got to ask me some questions. I have no knowledge of the forest.
She's a PhD candidate for mathematics.
Stop, okay.
Okay, well then I will stop.
No, go ahead.
She's very, very beautiful, obviously.
What's your last name?
He also
her
dates me.
Her name's very, very, very beautiful.
My last name is Krieger, which is German for warrior.
Is it kosher to see our kids up here? And, you know?
It's not kosher to discuss frat names in front of people that are getting frat names, though.
But
you can come up, but we got to talk about your name. But we can't talk about your name with you sitting there.
Go away for a little bit.
You should go away for a little bit.
All right, but I'll take my drink with me.
Well, no, leave your drink here.
No,
I will take care of it.
My idea is, her German name means warrior, right?
Yes.
So I was thinking Shogun.
That's a good one.
Yes.
Let's go. Right.
Pi-omega. Omega, omega, pi-omega, omega, pi-omega, omega, omega, pi-omega, omega, pi.
Who likes Shogun?
I do.
Who likes Shogun?
I do.
Yay, Shogun!
You know, to me, it's... carousing with your friends at a bar it's not a getting drunk or wasted thing. It's more of a group, and it's kind of like a big close-knit family, you know?
Hail, the gang's all here. What the heck do we care now?
That piece was produced by Matt Kessler. The voices you heard were Jungala, Bread, Hoss, Hooker, Double Down, Oss, Shotgun, and Moose. Members of Pi Omega Omega can be found at Mike and Molly's in downtown Champaign approximately 365 nights a year. This is Sidetrack. Tropical drinks served to you in flaming bowls by mysterious maidens. That was once the highlight of a trip to a Polynesian restaurant in the 1950s and 60s, and those days, sadly, are long gone. And the strange tropical drinks people enjoyed, well, they seemed lost to history until now. For several years, Jeff Barry has been searching out these forgotten drinks. He's been called a cocktail archaeologist. His most recent book is called Sippin' Safari, In Search of the Great Lost Tropical Drink Recipes and the People Behind Them. It's published by Club Tiki Press. In it, he traces the history of tiki bars in America, the drinks they served, and the people who mixed them. In fact, through rigorous research, he was able to track down Don the Beachcomber's famed zombie recipe, a holy grail for tropical drink aficionados. I talked with Barry for last December's program, and one of the things I asked him about was his search for the legendary drink, the zombie.
The zombie, as my friend Wayne Curtis says, that's my white whale. I was definitely Captain Ahab in search of this legendary lost drink. It's a perfect example of how complicated this whole thing got. All I was trying to do was get a recipe for a decent tropical drink that I could make for myself because I couldn't go to bars anymore and get one. And it literally took years to get this one. The zombie was probably the most famous tropical drink of all time, next to the Mai Tai. The Mai Tai was invented about 20 years after the zombie, so the zombie was really the thing in 1934 when Don the Beachcomber opened up his first restaurant that kind of took Hollywood by storm and then the rest of the country, and bars would open up calling themselves Zombie Hut or Zombie Island or whatever. The thing wasn't just the house drink in these places. They just named the restaurant after it. It was hugely famous in a way that maybe you could say the Cosmopolitan was after Sex and the City or stuff like that. But it was just huge. So it had to have been good. There must be something about that drink that kept people coming back and kept restaurants opening so they can serve it. But all of the zombie recipes I found over many years were just horrible, absolutely horrible. And if you could find a bar that served one, it would just be awful. It'd be like Hawaiian punch with a ton of rum, sort of like a tropical version of the Long Island iced tea. And if you look in drink guides from the 1940s or 50s, whenever the author of the book condescends to print a zombie recipe, they'll usually preface it by saying, this is just a gimmicky, horrible drink, and don't bother with this one. We just put it in because people ask about it. But there had to be something underneath all that. I mean, it must have started out being good. So I kept at it, and finally, after many years of trying, got a hold of some of the original Don the Beachcomber's employees' little recipe books. And these books were the private property of the people who worked at the bar at Don's. It was basically their passport to employment, because when they left Don's and they had these recipes, this little grimoire in their pocket, other restaurateurs would hire them because they knew how to make the drinks. And when they got hired, they did not tell their bosses what was in the recipes. The deal they usually made was, okay, I'll make these drinks for you, and you can put them on your menu and call them what you want and charge what you want, but you will not know what's in them. And when you fire me, I will take these drinks with me and I will go somewhere else. And a lot of bartenders had their entire careers based on these little private black books. So I finally got a hold of some of them, and I couldn't have been happier when I finally did. One was from 1937, which was 3 years after Don's opened, so I figured, okay, this one's got the original zombie. And it was in code. The recipe was in code so that nobody would steal it out of this guy's pocket. And then I had to crack the code, and that took another 2 years. Code words were things like, syrup Parisienne. And what could that be? At first I thought it might be grenadine because it sounded kind of French, but it wasn't. There were things like Marquesa, M-A-R-K-E-Z-A. Sounds kind of like Marquesas, you know, the Marquesas Islands. What could that have been? Then there were things like syrup number 2 and spices number 4 and dash of number 8. And it took years to crack that. The only way I could do it was by running into other ex-Beachcombers bartenders who had other books that were not coded. The booklet from 1937 was completely coded, but the one I got from the 1950s had partially decoded all that stuff. They'd just gotten a little more lax about it. And then finally, I got one from the 1970s, which actually had a lot of this stuff in a sort of like glossary, where they would have dashes number 2 through 8, and then right next to that, they would say what they were. So eventually, I was able to get all the ingredients except for one, this thing called Don's Mix. And that was just about a year ago when I finally found out what was in Don's Mix. It was grapefruit juice and spices number 4, which turned out to be a cinnamon syrup. So long story short, after about 10 years, I finally was able to drink a 1934 Beachcomber Zombie and see what all the fuss was about. And that's the recipe that I've got in the book, one of the 3 zombies I have in the book.
I mean, you go through some serious drink archaeology to find this stuff.
Yeah, it's right. Raiders of the Lost Liquor Cabinet or something like that. It really was top secret, because the drinks were what really paid the rent and made people's fortunes when they opened up a Polynesian-themed restaurant. These were conversation piece cocktails. This is what you talked about the next day around the water cooler after you went to Trader Vic's or Don the Beachcombers. Yeah, we had this thing in this ceremonial bowl with a flaming lime in the middle, or we got this grog served with an ice cone, and you sip the drink through a straw through the middle of the cone, and we got this one drink. I have no idea what was in it, but it was great. And the drink menus were elaborately illustrated with full-color illustrations and names like Missionary's Downfall or Mystery Gardenia. I mean, everything about them was supposed to conjure up this aura of mystery and tropical enchantment. And, you know, it wasn't the food that kept people going to these places. I mean, yeah, people like Chinese food, but they didn't have to go to an expensive Polynesian-themed restaurant to get Cantonese food. They could have gone down the street, you know, to a takeout place. Aside from the decor, it was the drinks that were the engine that kept these places going for sometimes up to 50 years. It was a really long lifespan for a drink fad. I mean, most drink fads die out after 5-10 years, but this one just kept going.
Well, this book of yours, Sippin' Safari, is not just a collection of these recipes. It also talks about the people who were involved in all these Polynesian restaurants and villages and resorts. And what I find fascinating is less about the businessmen who put these together, but about the guys who were behind the bar. That's the real character of these places. And what's really interesting is most of them were Filipino, and a lot of them had the same shared experience in the Philippines during World War II before they came to the U.S. to tend bar. Tell me a little bit about a few of the people you profile and how miraculously or strangely their lives paralleled one another.
Well, I'm really glad you asked me that, Jason, because that was the happiest accident of this book, was finding out the life stories of these guys. Basically, the book started out being my 4th recipe book. I mean, the previous 3 books were basically one recipe per page with a little blurb about the history of the drink or where it came from. And I was going to do that with this one as well, because I was just so single-minded about it. I just wanted to know what was in these drinks. But this time, when I finally actually started meeting the people who made the drinks and who had these little black books in their shirt pockets, in the course of talking to them and trying to extract the recipes from them with this sort of tunnel vision, single-mindedness, they just started telling me stories about their working lives or their lives before they ended up in a Polynesian restaurant. And it was amazing. And the book turned out to be the stories of these guys, and the recipes became almost sidebars. You know, they weren't the main event anymore. Filipinos were mostly what staffed these places, and I think it's because they couldn't get jobs anywhere else. I mean, they were part of the United States. I mean, it was a United States territory back in the 30s, and they could come to America and look for work, but they were marginalized. And the Filipino community in Hollywood, for example, was very small, and they all knew each other. So when somebody got off the boat and they were looking for work, their neighbors in this part of town would say, oh, well, try Don the Beachcombers. They're always hiring. So they ended up becoming waiters and bartenders. And part of that was because Don himself, when he was down and out and broke in Hollywood during Prohibition, he was taken in by some Filipinos, and they kind of taught him how to make drinks. And he said, when I get my restaurant, you guys are going to be my staff. And he kind of held fast to that, and for the entire lifespan of the restaurant, he hired Filipinos to the exclusion of the Chinese or Anglos who were jockeying for these jobs because the tips were great in these places. The interesting thing about these guys isn't just all the celebrities they served. I mean, first they would start telling me about, oh, yeah, Frank Sinatra liked his Navy grog fast, and he liked it cold, and if he didn't get it to him right away, he'd yell and scream, but he'd tip $50. There were all these celebrity stories. One told me that Bing Crosby was cheap and that Clark Gable was a big tipper. But what really interested me was when they started talking about their own histories before they even got to America. A lot of these guys, two of them, in fact, you mentioned, Jason, that their stories were parallel, were teenage revolutionaries during the Second World War. They were drafted into the underground, the Filipino underground, to fight the Japanese occupiers, and they were 15, 14 years old at the time. I mean, they ended up being, you know, bartenders who were just pouring Mai Tais for people in Hollywood or Chicago or New York, but they had these amazing childhoods, and they survived them, and they were incredibly tough guys who could basically, you know, get through anything by that point. One of them was this rich kid, Hank Riddle, grew up in wealth and privilege in a big mansion in Manila, and he would be taken to lunch at the same hotel with Douglas MacArthur, and he was chauffeured to school, and he had maids and laundresses and everything. Then the Japanese bombed Manila the night after they bombed Pearl Harbor, and he ended up sleeping in the jungle with the rest of his family and raiding Japanese fish canneries to try and feed himself, and his dad ended up in Santo Tomas, the concentration camp. And just an incredible reversal of fortune, and he ended up in Hollywood working as a waiter at Kelbo's and Don the Beachcombers and worked his way up to a manager in Palm Springs, and just the story was just like mind-blowing. I mean, by the time his family got through telling me his story, I didn't even care about the recipes anymore.
Well, it is absolutely amazing how these guys came to bartend, and then they just did not want to leave it. I mean, you explain in the book that bartending at these Polynesian restaurants was not an easy thing.
Well, you're right. It's very interesting how they came to love the work so much. Particularly a guy named Bob Ismino, who was an American citizen. He was having a normal American Henry Aldridge style childhood in Oregon, you know, high school track team, walking home every day doing his homework and band practice and all that. And his family decides to take a vacation in the Philippines in 1939. He ends up getting stuck there, and he ends up fighting in the Filipino underground and coming back. He's still a teenager. He's still in high school when he gets back to America after the war. And he ends up at the Contiki restaurant in Portland just because he's bored at his job cleaning coaches on the railroad, goes over there because they're hiring, and he ends up just loving the work. And what he loved about it was it used his mind, it used his resources. Everything that toughened him up in the Philippines when he was fighting barefoot in the jungle prepared him for the kind of work that he had to do there. These drinks, as we mentioned before, were very complicated drinks. Some of them had 15 ingredients, secret dashes of this and that and the other thing. They had to be blended with a very precise amount of ice for the right kind of dilution and chill. They were served in these elaborately garnished vessels, flaming this, ice cone that. It took 20 guys working at the same time in a assembly line Henry Ford fashion to get these drinks out to customers fast enough. So you basically had this factory setup which had to work like clockwork. And Bob explained to me why he loved the work so much. He was constantly on his toes, constantly thinking, constantly trying to streamline getting these drinks made and get them out. And when he became a bar manager, he was completely absorbed in getting the team to function properly and mechanically and whip these things out. Because these places were so popular, you sometimes had lines around the block of people getting in, wanting to get in and get these drinks. It was a lot of work, and it was a lot of intricately choreographed work. So, yeah, you're right, Jason. It wasn't just, you know, pouring a drink. It was almost an intellectual exercise that required a lot of physical stamina, something that a teenager who fought in the, you know, in the Filipino underground in the jungle can kind of sink his teeth into.
So why is it important to find these old recipes, to find the histories of these people, to find these elements of these bars that are no longer around.
Well, for me, what's important about it is, these drinks were worth saving. The best of them, the original Beachcomber recipes, the ones that I'd been hunting for all this time, really are amazing drinks. They were about 50 years ahead of their time. Now in the cocktail world, there's been kind of an international resurgence of cocktails after they kind of lay fallow for a long time and people were just drinking wine or beer. But now in cities all over the world, there's a huge cocktail resurgence, and bartenders are coming up with elaborate new drinks, and they're not even called bartenders anymore. You'll find them being called bar chefs, because they're taking a culinary approach and using all kinds of rare, interesting ingredients and things you would normally find more in the kitchen than the bar, and doing all kinds of like amazing fantasias on a theme. But this is exactly what Don the Beachcomber and Trader Vic were doing in the 1930s and 40s. 50 years before all these people were doing that, that's exactly what they were doing. They were using spices like allspice, and they were making mixes out of honey and fresh crushed pureed mangoes and pineapples, and using all kinds of weird spices and ingredients to create these drinks. And they were culinary events, really. They were enduring first-rate recipes, and the fact that they were lost to time was only because they kept them so secret, because they didn't want anybody to steal them. That kind of backfired in the long run, because now nobody really knows that they were that good, and they don't endure the way a lot of other classic cocktails do. But I think it's, to answer your question, Jason, what's important is to rescue these from obscurity so that people can experience them and use them, and so that these new bar chefs can take them and run with them and do even more interesting things with them, and just sort of like keep them in the food chain, so to speak, the food and drink chain. What's important about the other aspects of this vanished civilization? Well, it's not exactly a cure for cancer or a renewable form of energy. To me, I only seem to be able to get serious about trivial things, and this was the one trivial thing that that just sort of obsessed me. And I can't say that it's important to the world at large, but it seems to have been important to me for a while anyway.
That was Jeff Berry, author of Sippin' Safari, In Search of the Great Lost Tropical Drink Recipes and the People Behind Them. It's published by Club Tiki Press. That interview first aired last December. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.